It was my birthday just a few weeks ago, the beginning of September, and about 10 days before my birthday, Melissa is trying to figure out what to get me, so she ordered me a new Whitecaps soccer jersey. My favorite player, Kendall Watson, he's 6'5", awesome, and always talks about Jesus, so I like him. And so she orders me this jersey, and it's 3 to 7 days shipping. 24 days later, we're emailing them going, I mean, he's going to retire soon, where's the jersey, it's been so long. How come this hasn't arrived? And well, I was able to track the package, and we see that it's stuck somewhere, like in Bellingham. So it was supposed to go to Point Roberts, and it didn't make it. And so we're emailing them, where is this? What's happening? We get an email back from the company saying, your package was delayed due to wildfires on the West Coast. What? Where are these West Coast wildfires that are blocking the FedEx truck? You know, is Bellingham on fire? Did I miss something? Did the FedEx driver pull over and help and volunteer to put the fire out? How does the wildfire in the West Coast affect the FedEx package from getting to Point Roberts? I don't understand how this. What's the delay here? So I thought, you know, if they get to use this wildfire excuse, I should start using this as well. You know, so Steve, you know, rolls into the office around noon. Well, you know, the wildfires, guys, I wasn't really able to get here. You know, that sermon really last week was truly awful, Steve. What happened there? Well, preparation, I just wasn't able to prepare at all with, the wildfires. It was a rough week in that way. You understand, wildfires and all. There's some crazy excuses that we use for things, isn't there? You're talking to me, there's weird things. When I'm talking to people often in the community, you know, meeting new people, and they find out I'm a pastor. What people seem to want to do, I find this a little bit odd, but what they want to do is somehow like build a bridge there by letting me know that they have faith as well in some ways. I was talking to the Rogers people. They were trying to sell me a bigger phone plan. It was very unsuccessful. But he finds out, what do you do? They find out I'm a pastor, and he says, oh, my sister's a nun. Now we have a bond, right, somehow. So people will say, you know, this is my... I have faith. I belong to this. I belong to that. So they want to kind of build that connection. But then what they find so often is now they have to make an excuse for why they actually aren't part of a church. So it's like they've gone, oh, he's a pastor. I'm whatever. You know, my sister's a nun. And then they realize they're in too deep and they have to go, oh, but I don't actually, now they're backpedaling. And they come up with some excuse for why they don't actually belong to a church. So I have heard, this happens so often, it's very amusing to me, because people are just having this conversation with themselves, almost, and giving all kinds of really lame excuses for why they believe in Jesus, but don't belong to a church. So I've heard many reasons, and that's our question, though, today. Is that possible? Does this matter? Does church actually matter? I believe in Jesus. We talked about the forgiveness of Jesus, why we all need Jesus, but does church matter? Does it matter if you go to church or not? And belonging to church. So last week, we said, everyone needs Jesus because Jesus offers us grace. He's the only one that offers us grace. We're broken. We're sinful. We're at the end of our rope. We need God's grace. And Jesus is the only way of receiving grace and forgiveness because he's the only one who's paid our debt, absorbed the cost of our wrong. So every religion of the world says, do these things, keep these rules, and do the right things, then maybe you'll be good enough for God. But the gospel says is the opposite. It says stop trying to prove yourself to God. Instead, receive his grace by trusting in Jesus instead of yourself. So everyone needs Jesus. But, question, does everyone need the church? Does everyone need the church? I've got Jesus and I don't need the church, someone might say. Or I like Jesus, it's his bride I'm not crazy about, right? I'm not sure about Jesus' people. They're kind of nuts. Is solo Christianity... just me and Jesus. Is that even possible? Is that a thing? A lot of people are living like that is the thing. So we're going to look at Colossians 3. So you can turn there with me. Page 984. There's lots of different ways I could answer this question. Because in a sense, the New Testament is all about Jesus' church. There isn't a ministry. There isn't there's very little in the New Testament that isn't revolving around God's plan for building his kingdom through the church. So we could go answer this question a number of ways, but I wanted to answer this question from Colossians chapter 3. We're going to look at verse 12 to 17. And And what we're looking at is Paul painting this picture for why the church is valuable, what the church should look like, and how it can be, how it must be central to our lives. So Colossians 3, the whole chapter, to kind of put it in context, is it's talking about living in line with the reality of the gospel. If Jesus died for you, if Jesus rose from the grave, if we have forgiveness and are welcomed into God's family, which is kind of everything that's come before chapter 3, if those things are all true, which they are, there are certain implications for how we live. So, you know, last week we talked about the gospel, that we can be forgiven and accepted by God by his grace because Jesus absorbed the debt for us, which we receive through faith. Today, then, we're going to, therefore, in light of that truth, if that's true, there are certain ways, certain things we ought to do. There's a way we ought to live in light of that reality, that truth. So, verse 5 to 11, Paul lists all kinds of evil behaviors and says, put them to death. That's the old way. That's the old broken, you know, we're part of a new humanity, and that's what's destroying the world. We're not part of that anymore. That's the things that God has rescued us from. So put them behind. Get rid of them. God has something better for us. And then in verse 12, which we're going to look at, he begins to describe this new community that we're called to belong to. Speaking to Christians, he's reminding them of what it looks like when we belong together in a church. And that's what I want to focus on today. Okay, so verse 12, this is what it says. Put on, then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. And be thankful. We'll pause there. So the starting place for our how things ought to look like in the church is in our identity as God's people. You are God's, here's how he starts, you are God's chosen ones, holy and beloved. God has chosen you. He's made you holy. He loves you. And that's where you have to start. Who are we? That's where we begin. Later on, he's going to say, you are forgiven by Jesus in verse 13. In verse 15, you are called into one body. So this is identity. This is who we are. And that's the starting place for church. Who are we? You're called into one body. You belong together. You're not disconnected individuals just kind of happen to be in the same room at the same time, a whole bunch of individuals, but you are a collection. You are a collective. You belong together into one body. So it's not a whole bunch of me. It's us. It's we. And that's where he starts. We have an identity of belonging together. And so by faith, we are saved by Jesus from our sin. But it doesn't stop there. We're saved from our sin and saved into a family. We belong. See, that's the part that most of us, or often, we forget. One of the most common pictures for salvation, there's many different images and metaphors, is that of adoption. Is it saved into something, into a family, into a belonging, into a group of people, into this family of God. So we're saved from something, sin, Satan, death, ourselves, and we're saved into something, a family, a community, a new humanity, a new creation. God is remaking broken humanity, and he's doing it through the church. And so we belong. And he uses this body image. It's actually one of the most common images. You'll see it in other places, particularly in Paul's letters, of this image of a body. What's the idea here? We're parts, each individual parts of a body. The church is a body. And the idea is that there are many diverse parts. We're very, very different from each other, right? And yet, belonging together, working together. And now, I hope we all know that the church is not, you know, an event or a program, but is a people, a family, right? I think we get that, that the church is the people. But even then, we still typically think of the church in terms of what it can do for me as an individual. It seems that that's how most of us think. We think of a local church as where the purpose of the local church is I go so I can learn about God through teaching and I can connect with God through music and sacraments or that prayer, that type of thing. So it's about me learning, me connecting. We know that the church isn't the building or the program, but it's the people. But we still think of it as individualistically. What do I get out of it? I don't really get much out of it. I get lots out of that. I want to go there, I get more out of it. So I'm thinking about what I get, Okay? And so, this is how we shop around for churches, and we think about the church where I'm going to connect the best. Now, I think that good teaching really matters. I hope to do some in my lifetime at some point. I think that connecting with God really matters, and connecting with God in the local church really matters. But I think we miss something when we think of the church based on, we measure a church based on what it offers people. When we make it about my personal individual growth and my personal individual worship, as if the other people in the room are totally irrelevant. Like we're all just doing an individual thing and happen to be in the same room together. I think we're missing something about what a church really is. And the image of the image is a body, not a store. The image is a body, not a performance. The body image means that church is more about us being something together than it is about us doing something or providing something. It means that we don't gather just to each as individuals get something, though we might, but rather bigger than that, to be something together. That we are something together that we can't be on our own. And when we view church primarily in terms of learning about God and connecting with Him, we miss out on what God is calling us to be as a church. In fact, we may even leave the church altogether. Someone might say, I can do church at home, watching on TV, because I get something, right? I'm listening to my iPod. Do we still have those? iPhone. I'm listening to music, and that's connecting with God, or I have personal devotions, or I watch teaching on TV, so I'm getting something. I'm doing church. Can I be provocative for a moment? It's kind of my shtick. That's not a church. I don't care how good the teaching is. Watching TV is not a church. Or people say, where two or three are gathered. You are totally butchering that verse. That verse is not defining what a church is. It's actually about church discipline, if you look it up, Matthew 18. So we have this view of church where it's about me getting teaching. And so anytime I'm like watching TV church, I'm in a church. That's not a church. The reformers, Protestant reformers, as they wrestled with this question, what is a true church and what is not? Because for the first time, they thought about the possibility of a church that's not the Holy Roman Catholic Church. So they were asking this question. It became a very important question at that time. What is a church? What makes a church a church? And they came up with this, that they taught that a true church only exists where, and they said three things happen. One, the word of God is rightly preached and taught. So you might get that on TV, kind of. Secondly, that the sacraments are rightly administered. That baptism and the Lord's Supper make a church. And thirdly, that the biblical leaders are exercising church discipline. That there's people being called to account, not living in sin, but there's accountability and shepherding going on. So, preaching the word, the sacraments, baptism, Lord's Supper, and church discipline, that there's this call to belong into holiness. And that's where a local church, where you have those things, you have a church. And where you don't have those things, you don't have a church. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong to listen to good preachers. I actually think that's a good thing to do. It's just not a church, right? Connecting with God through worship music, go to a worship concert, that's great. It's lovely. It's just not a church. It's not a local church. The church isn't primarily about connecting with God. It's about being something, being God's people together. So we are a gospel-shaped community, a people, a new humanity that have been shaped around the truth of what Jesus has done for us, marked by this gospel truth. We proclaim the gospel not only with our words, but through our life together, through our gathering together, through our singing, through our being together and being a unique community. And so we make Jesus known as we gather, as we pursue him, as we reflect the gospel to each other and as we obey his commands. We proclaim the gospel through being a new community. So I hope you do learn and grow through teaching. I hope you connect with God through music. But recognize that more than just individual growth, there is something beautiful that happens as we gather, and something that is much bigger than just my own growth, but it's something that we are together. So, we start with who are we? That's the first part as we think about church, and does it matter? We start with who we are and move from there in the passage to what we ought to do. So there's the indicative, this is who you are, always comes before the imperative, this is what you must do. In fact, religion switches these, doesn't it? Religion says, do the right things, this is what you need to do, in hopes that you will be good enough for God, that you will fit in, you'll belong, and you'll be part of God's people. But the gospel is actually opposite. This is who you are by grace. Therefore, in light of your new reality, your new belonging, your adoption into his family, therefore live in light of that reality that's already true. It's not about earning, it's about living out of it. So, in light of who we are, God's people, chosen, loved, forgiven, welcomed into the body, we therefore live a certain way as part of this new humanity. So how do we live together? That's what he's listing, describing, painting this vision of what it looks like. How do we treat others? With compassionate hearts, showing care for others, with kindness, a sort of a gracious sensitivity towards others, motivated by a genuine care for others, with humility, laying aside our need for glory and attention, and instead being willing to serve, willing to not be in the center all the time. Meekness, gentleness, patience, a willingness to endure the wrongs of others, and bearing with one another, forgiving each other. When others sin against us, we respond with love and patience and grace. And then he says, put on love, which binds everything together. See, Christians aren't automatically unified. We sometimes expect this and are so disappointed when it doesn't work out that way. But harmony isn't automatic or natural. It's quite unnatural. What's natural is disharmony, because we're all selfish, proud, and greedy, and we put ourselves first ahead of others. So naturally, we will come into conflict. Disharmony is natural. Harmony is supernatural. So love doesn't mean that we will all get along splendidly all the time. It means we're going to put others first. Love binds people together who otherwise would not get along, would not be a good fit. And then it says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. What does that mean? So Jesus came to break down the old divisions, to bring peace where there was disunity. The old rivalries, Jew and Gentile, male and female, slave and free, the old divisions there, who's in and who's out. Jesus breaks these down and brings peace. And so the church must let that peace rule. And it's all based on what Jesus has done for us, all of these things that he's talked about. We forgive, he says, as those who have been forgiven. That's really, really crucial. We love as those who have been loved. So the church is called to be a sort of mirror of the gospel, reflecting what is true for God's relationship with us to each other. What God has done for us in grace, we are called to show to each other. So we need to view people then the way Jesus does. We need to treat people the way Jesus does. So it's not about getting even. It's not about what's fair. Thank goodness that God does not treat us in a way that is fair, but instead he treats us with grace. So we think about the sins of people, and did they deserve love? Did they deserve forgiveness? Did they deserve God's grace? And the answer, of course, is no. I did not deserve God's grace, but I've received God's grace. And then that is the attitude with which I have to look at other people. Do they deserve it? Do they deserve kindness? No. Did I? No. But the same forgiveness that was shown to me, the same grace poured out on us, we reflect to others. So the church is a mirror of the gospel in that way, reflecting to each other the grace that we've received. So the gospel is not just something we believe in the privacy of our own little hearts, just me and Jesus, but it's something transformative that gets worked out in community. We experience it from God, and then we work it out with each other in our relationships. So the Christian community isn't perfect, right? There's a saying among pastors, the church would be perfect if it weren't for all the people. And it's not a club of righteous people, it's a community of people who are looking for grace. We're broken, we sin, we've been hurt, and we hurt others. When people are dating or engaged, you know, they're moving towards marriage maybe, they think, you know, they seem to think that when they get married, it will, like, smooth out all the troubles, right? And it'll make things better somehow. It'll fix all the kind of quirks once we get married. It'll be better once we get married. The problem is that when people get married, you have two people who are both sinners. They're both proud, they're both selfish, they're both greedy. They both put themselves first naturally. And the problem is every bride and every groom is a sinner, and marriage doesn't fix their sin problem. In fact, it does the opposite. It magnifies it. That's the difficult truth, is that marriage actually makes it worse, not better. Not that it makes you a worse person, but it reveals that which was always there. It's because it's a magnifying glass. That's what marriage is. So it shows and exposes cracks, problems, sins that you didn't even realize you had. The problem is deeper than you realize, and your marriage exposes it, because the closer and more intimate a relationship is, whether marriage or friendship or whatever, the closer any relationship is, the more easily we see each other's sin and failure and brokenness, and we hurt each other. Everyone looks good on their resume. Everyone looks perfect on Facebook. But it's in real life, in the ups and downs of real life, that the everyday intimacy that we see people's sin. We see their failure. We hurt each other. Strangers don't see your sin. They think you're great. But your spouse, your closest friends, they know where you fail. And so the closer the relationship, the more we see each other's sin and we'll hurt each other. So the same applies to a church. Why would we expect any different? As we enter into community, as we see each other's sin, we will hurt each other at times. Paul knows that. He's assuming that here in Colossians 3. This picture of this wonderful community is not because we all get along splendidly. He's talking about things like patience, bearing with one another. You don't need patience and to bear with someone who's perfect. You just think, oh, they're great. We should hang out with them more. No, you need patience for annoying people. You need to bear with people who hurt you and do mean things. I can't believe it. Right? That's when you need patience, is because we're going to hurt each other and fail. We need to give and receive forgiveness like Jesus forgave us, because we're going to hurt each other. We need love to bind us together, because without it, we are not together. We are enemies. Things will fall apart because we're so selfish, we're going to pull in opposite directions. We need the peace of Christ to rule in our hearts, because without it, we will hurt each other. All we'll have is the combativeness of my own selfishness. So this life that Paul's describing, what a church ought to look like, isn't a description of some utopian paradise, the perfect church where everyone gets along and loves each other perfectly, a list of all the qualities that they have. No, it's a list of the qualities that we need to cultivate if we're actually going to survive and walk together, if we're going to belong together, if we're going to be unified, if we're not going to kill each other. This is what we need. We need patience, forgiveness, forbearance, and love binding us together, the peace of Christ ruling in our hearts. We aren't a perfect community. If there was a perfect church, just so you know, they wouldn't let you in. Or me either. You're not qualified. Instead, what we're called to be is not a perfect community that does everything right and never hurts each other. We're called to be a community that mirrors the gospel. We are going to fail each other, but the question is not will we fail, but what will we do when we do fail? What will we do when we hurt each other? What Paul's calling us to, what the Bible's calling us to, is to be a people who have the gospel at the center, and therefore, when we hurt each other, we can forgive as we are forgiven. We can love as we've been loved. We can be patient as God has been patient with us. And so we reflect the gospel to each other. We don't give other people what they deserve, because God hasn't given us what we deserve. He's given us grace. And that's why we put a lot of our emphasis on our community groups and things like that. Paul's talked about that. It's not a program, but it's a family. People committed to doing life together, walking together. We get close enough that we may even hurt each other. But we need other people helping us, encouraging us when we're down, praying for us, pursuing us when we stray, correcting us when we're wrong. We need help along the way, all of us, every one of us. We don't grow in the same way on our own. You can have some measure of growth completely as an isolated individual, but not in the same way. It's not God's plan for our growth. On our own, what we'll naturally do, if you think about it, with no one there to correct, or teach, or help, or guide, pray for you, on your own, what you'll do is you'll naturally just reaffirm your own beliefs, your own sinful lifestyle, your own broken pattern of thinking. On our own, we'll just keep justifying our behavior. Because we can only see it through our sinful kind of worldview, and there's no one there to correct us and to teach us and to help us. We'll only trust ourselves, but ourselves are not trustworthy. So on our own, we'll get caught in like a feedback loop, just listening to ourselves echoing back forever, and it's destructive, and we miss out what God has for us. And if we don't do this, just me and Jesus Christianity, it's easier. It's much easier. No one helping you out, but it's not better. It's not healthy. It's easy, but it's not good. We need each other. We're better together. It's not always easy. We may even hurt each other. We'll let each other down, but we're better off as we reflect the love and forgiveness of Christ to each other. We know Jesus better as we walk in community with people who need Jesus as badly as we do. So the church is a community that walks together in love, reflecting the gospel. A community that walks together in love, reflecting the gospel to each other and to the world. But he's not done. Look at verse 16. The next thing he says is, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God." Well, let's just focus on the first half of that, though. We'll get to the second half in a sec. Here's the kind of the second attribute. So the first is this belonging together, this walking in love, reflecting the gospel. The second thing that Paul says needs to be part of the local church is it is centered on the word. Centered on the word of Christ. The word of Christ being God's word to us, the revelation of Jesus Christ as we read it in the scriptures. So, and he says, let it dwell in you. Now, I was thinking about that. It's actually the opposite of what you'd expect. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. We would normally probably think we need to dwell in the word, right? We dwell in the word. We gather around the word. It's home for us, right? But it says, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. It dwells, we allow it to dwell in us, which means it needs to make its way into our hearts and into our lives. We need to let the word reside within us. So often we just give lip service to the word. Yeah, we claim it as an authority. Oh yeah, I follow the Bible. But we honestly don't give it much thought, almost no thought. We may not read it all week, and even when we hear it taught, we're not really thinking much about it, just kind of passing us by. But what we need is what we do is we resist it, but what we need is to let it dwell within us. It's a rich image. Let it dwell within us richly. Internalize it. Grab hold of it. You grab hold of it like a starving man given fresh bread. You drink deeply from its wells. You find life. And it dwells within you. That's what we're called to do. And that's what a church ought to do, is to let the word of Christ dwell among us and in us richly. Richly. Not poorly, but richly. There's a hungering for and running to the word. And then what that leads to, this is fascinating, teaching and admonishing one another. Huh. When we let the word of Christ dwell in us, it will naturally come out of us. It's in our hearts and on our lips, which means we become a community that is teaching, admonishing each other. So when the word of Christ dwells in us richly, we all become teachers. Everyone in the community teaching, encouraging, helping, pointing people to the scriptures, pointing people to Christ, helping each other. Everyone a teacher. So being a community of the word, you know, we're word-centered. Being a community of the word doesn't mean you have a professional teacher who opens the word for us. That's lovely, but that's not what this says, right? That's the beginning, but there's something more that's going on here. When the word of Christ dwells in us, and we all become teachers, speaking the word to each other, admonishing each other. Now, think about the alternative. What if that's not true? What's the alternative? An individual Christian cut off from a community of the word. Without the wisdom of others, teaching, admonishing with all wisdom, without people to teach us and correct us and encourage us and help us, remind us of the gospel, what we do is we simply continue to reaffirm our wrong thinking, justifying our sin, continuing on with our foolish beliefs. Because we all have broken patterns of thought that need to be corrected and helped and trained from the word and from each other. With no community to sharpen our thinking and to point us to Jesus when we get distracted, we easily just get lost, we get distracted, we get off course, and we get stuck in bad patterns. We need a community of the word. It's how God has called us to grow. God has spoken and God is speaking to us in the Bible, and we need God and His Word. So it has to be at the center. It has to be at the center. And we need not just one person teaching, but we need to, every one of us, internalize it so that we're able to teach each other. So the Word dwelling richly in us together leads us to this really amazing joy and thankfulness. Look at the fruit that it bears. Verse 16, again, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. So the word leads to worship. We gather around the word, it dwelling deeply within us, and we each teaching, admonishing each other, the word in our hearts and on our lips. And this leads to singing and thankfulness. The word leads to worship. It's actually why we structure our gatherings the way we do. The word leads us to worship. We hear from God as we open His word. We respond to God in singing, prayer, communion, giving. It's like all of life. God initiates, we respond. God shows His grace, we respond. The word is at the center, leading to singing and joy and thanksgiving. So that's really kind of the third attribute that Paul shows us of the church, that the church is a thankful community, a worshiping community, a joyful community. Through our love for each other, through the word dwelling in us, through our singing, we are cultivating thanksgiving. Thankful hearts towards God. So as we gather, what we're doing is we aim to cultivate thanksgiving in our hearts together. And so everything we do ought to lead to a greater thankfulness towards God, recognizing His grace, being reminded again of His goodness to us. Even in communion, we're celebrating what Christ has done for us on the cross for those who believe. We're reminding each other in this of the gospel, helping each other to be thankful again. Because it's easy for us to forget to be thankful. It's easy for us to take things for granted and to become, instead of full of gratitude, to just be greedy or to lose sight of God's grace for us. And so our job is to remind each other so that we are thankful, filled with gratitude. Now, what happens if we don't have this? What happens if we're isolated from a thankful community, community of worship and gratitude? We easily lose sight of the gospel. We fall into maybe despair or anger or bitterness or hurt when something comes in our life. We can get off track so easily. We forget God's grace. We forget the gospel. We forget all that we've been given. And we lose our joy. It's very easy for us, without a thankful community, to keep pointing us back to Jesus, pointing us back to what God's grace has been for us. It's very easy for us to lose sight of that. We need other people's help to keep Jesus first. And so we open the word together. We sing together with thankful hearts. We walk together in love. We teach each other. So, does the church matter? If you believe in Jesus, do you need a local church? We have to remember that Jesus saves us from our sin, but saves us into a new community, a new family. Churchless Christianity is deficient at best and can be quite damaging as we isolate ourselves from others and from the gifts that God has given to us to help us grow. That God has provided great gifts to us that we might grow in Him, and yet we're not availing ourselves to them when we cut ourselves off from community. Jesus called us into this community, this new humanity, not as a way of us to like prove something or to check all the lists, but for our good. And for the good of the whole church, that we need each other. And so we walk together in love, even when that's hard. We will fail each other. We will hurt each other. It's true. But we learn the gospel more deeply as we reflect it to others, forgiving each other as we're forgiven by Jesus. And we open the word together, not just as sort of a rote practice or lip service, just something we're supposed to do, but letting the word dwell richly in us. Immersing ourselves so that it shapes us and changes us, guides us, gives us life and energy and power. with the word in our hearts and on our lips, we will teach each other, admonish each other, building each other up. And we will spur each other on to greater thankfulness, joy, and worship. We sing together with thankful hearts. Every Sunday we gather to celebrate together. It's a celebration of the resurrection. Our sin is forgiven. The tomb is empty. Jesus is alive. So we get together and sing again because we have so much to be thankful for. Does the church matter? Where else will we go? Where else will we go? The church is God's plan for building his kingdom on earth. The church is God's people. At the end of all things, it's Jesus and his bride. It's Jesus and the church. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. That's the whole point, is we're broken and we need Jesus. We will hurt each other. We will let each other down. But in the midst of all our failure, we are a people who have found grace and need to show grace to each other. We're a people who need Jesus and know it. We're a people who need each other to remind each other of the truth of the gospel. That we need the church because it's God's plan for making us strong and helping us survive this life with thankful hearts. Let's pray together.